Joining us to discuss the Ukrainian refugee crisis are Chana Gadini-Williams, head of global communications at UNHCR, who's been on the ground on the Ukrainian border with neighboring countries. She joins us from Budapest. And Kate White, emergency program manager with Doctors Without Borders in Geneva. Thank you both for joining me on Upfront. Chana, I'll start with you. UNHCR is on the ground meeting refugees from Ukraine at the border of neighboring countries. Can you talk to us a little bit about the situation on the ground, what refugees have been facing, and how the organization has been responding to it?
Yeah, fortunately, we've had a presence both inside Ukraine and in the neighboring countries for about the last 30 years. So we had our teams ready when the war first broke out, and we've been at the borders in Romania and Moldova and Poland and also here in Hungary. The situation is right now, it's very well organized in terms of the reception of refugees, but the clear tragedy and the impacts on the hundreds of thousands of refugees that are arriving every day is so visible.
Kate, we're seeing an immense outpouring of support for Ukrainian refugees right now. Doctors Without Borders also has a presence in Ukraine, and your teams are witnessing the impact of the conflict on civilians. What are the biggest needs right now in terms of support?
I think in terms of support and what our teams are seeing, it varies quite dramatically depending upon where in the country you are. Our teams in the east around Mariupol right now are basically just trying to survive, given they've been completely cut off. There's no water, there's no electricity, they're running out of food. So really there, it's about safe passage for those who need to be able to flee and ensuring that humanitarian and medical supplies can come into the city. Further west in the country, we're seeing both indirect and direct consequences of the war in terms of, from a health perspective, trauma patients that are really creating a significant burden on the remaining functional health structures. And then beyond that, there are multiple needs in regard to pre-existing conditions of people that are being exacerbated because they no longer have access to health services.
Chana, what kind of challenges do you anticipate refugees will be facing in the coming months? We know that the situation is developing very quickly on the ground.
I think one of the things that we're most concerned about is that the people that are arriving now are the ones who have means. They have resources, they have family, they have connections, either in the neighboring countries or further afield. What we're really worried about is that the people who have not crossed yet are the ones that will be more at risk. We're talking about refugees who will be elderly or living with disabilities. We're also talking about people who probably have less in terms of resources and ability to move out now. The other issue that we cannot avoid, and this will carry on for the next months, is that every single refugee family that comes across are separated from loved ones. They've left loved ones and family members behind, and this will weigh very heavily on the way that we are able to respond to their needs in the coming months.
Kate, headlines are proclaiming that Europe has opened its doors to Ukrainian refugees and that, quote, EU nations unanimously agreed to accept Ukrainian refugees for 3 years without going through asylum process. Now, while we can agree that these are positive moves, to be sure, why have the doors been shut to African, Asian, and Middle Eastern asylum seekers for so long?
That's a very, very good question that I'm not sure I am able or qualified to answer. But indeed, in terms of what we've seen as Médecins Sans Frontières responding in various countries within Europe to refugee crisis, this is dramatically different from how it has worked in the past.
Chana, there are some pretty stark shifts. For example, just a few years ago, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban was building barbed wire fences and barriers to keep refugees out, creating teams of border hunters to stop asylum seekers, and said, quote, for us, migration is a poison. We don't need it and won't swallow it. Now he's welcoming Ukrainian refugees in with open arms. Similarly, Poland began constructing a wall to prevent asylum seekers from entering the country through its border with Belarus, an area where at least a dozen asylum seekers froze to death this past winter. Now they're building a rail link to Ukraine to help refugees enter Poland. I want to keep building on this. What do you think is behind the shift, not just in rhetoric, but also in practice?
I think one thing that is critical here, and there's nothing positive that's coming out of this war, but I think one thing that we are focusing on is that this is an opportunity to shift this narrative, to say that that if shared, the responsibility of welcoming and supporting refugees is manageable. We are able to do this. European countries and international community overall is able to do this. The other thing that I've seen here, and I was at the railway station today here in Budapest, and I saw two trains arrive filled with refugees from Ukraine. And many of them were actually third country nationals. So a lot of students from Africa. I spoke to several from Tanzania, from Congo, and from Ethiopia. They also were saying, look, right now, Ukraine is our home. We were, you know, one of them was just about 6 months away from graduating. So they're really unsure whether or not they want to try to wait and see if they can go back and finish their studies. And I think what we've seen in Hungary is that they're saying anyone coming from Ukraine right now, we consider a refugee, and they're being treated exactly the same, which, as you say, is something that we welcome.
Chana, there are many Africans and South Asians currently living in Ukraine who have faced significant delays or even been completely blocked from leaving the country. For example, a Nigerian national and father of three said he and his family were asked to give up their seats on a cross-border bus out of Ukraine, with Ukrainian military officers saying, no blacks allowed. Can you speak about what black and brown residents are facing when they try to flee this war?
I think in terms of UNHCR's position, we've made it very clear there can be no discrimination based on nationality, ethnicity, or race. People that are fleeing from Ukraine, regardless of their nationality or background, are fleeing the same conflict, and they deserve the same right to access asylum and to have safety. That said, in terms of what's happening inside Ukraine, it's very difficult for us to assess. We have, like you, heard these incidents, seen these reports, and we followed up both inside Ukraine and in the neighboring countries to work with the governments to make sure that these are not policies and that they are not going to be replicated. And so far, we do have assurances on both sides that anyone who is trying to escape the war in Ukraine will be allowed to do so and will have safety and asylum on the other side.
Kate, is Doctors Without Borders doing anything to help these racialized refugees?
So for us, we treat people regardless of their race, ethnicity, or background. But what we're seeing more broadly in Ukraine itself is a difficulty for population as a whole to flee, particularly from areas in the east where cities are becoming besieged and populations are struggling to move out. And for us, in terms of the services that are being provided in the countries surrounding Ukraine, these populations can be some of the most vulnerable. And we're trying as hard as we can to follow and to look into this because it's extremely difficult at the moment, though, to track what happens to people once they cross the border. They are spending 1-2 days in reception centres before moving on. So this is it's early days.
Kate, is there any need for a more targeted response? It seems that the UNHCR and Doctors Without Borders has effectively taken a colorblind approach, saying, whoever you are, if you're in need, we're going to help. But if there is a disproportionate number of racialized people being mistreated, being pushed off of buses, being denied access to refuge, might there be a need for these organizations to actually overcorrect for that by targeting these racialized groups?
No, indeed. So when we look at populations in a context, what we are looking at is what services are being provided and who are the most vulnerable. And we are in a similar position to China and UNHCR in a way that whilst we hear many of these reports and we hear it in the news, in terms of what our teams are able to see right now, we're not actually able to see a systematic case of discrimination. However, given that it is so widely reported, it is one of the things that we're looking at doing in terms of supporting, because then that becomes an extremely marginalized population without the same access to the system that others have.
China, we've also seen the media, including an Al Jazeera presenter, come under fire for the way that they have described Ukrainian refugees compared to other asylum seekers. Some of the worst examples include reporters and commentators saying things like, Ukraine, unlike Iraq and Afghanistan, is civilized, and that Ukrainians have blue eyes and blonde hair. How do these dehumanizing descriptions affect how people not just view, but ultimately treat asylum seekers?
Absolutely. I'm actually glad you brought that up, Mark, because I think the way that we talk about refugees in general across media it's become such a negative thing. Refugee has become such a negative word. And yet I think maybe the one thing that we're learning in this crisis is that absolutely anybody can become a refugee. And I have to say one of the journalists that I spoke to recently said a similar thing. And I did ask him, so are you saying that if a refugee who looks like me or who looks somebody from Africa, are you saying that this is different? And I did. I think it's important that all of us actually face this. We talk about this and we talk about this difference. Now, what I can say is that if anything, this is showing that life is very fragile and it can change in a matter of minutes. I've met so many people in the last week along the border who literally had 15 minutes to decide what to take because the shelling started getting so bad or so close that they decided instantly, like, we have to go and we have to go now. And so I think the one thing that we can try to do is not so much talk about how everybody is like us, but really talk about how we all live in a world that is very vulnerable and very fragile and that can turn on its head. And so hopefully that will allow us to have a bit more compassion and to really be a bit more open about how we think about displacement overall.
I want to thank you both, China and Kate, for joining me on Upfront.